A quick warning. This episode contains racial slurs and depictions of violence. We advise listener discretion. When I covered Timothy McVeigh's trial in 1997, the prosecutors tried to do one thing: prove that McVeigh set off the bomb at the Murrah Building. And they did just that. They showed that McVeigh bought the bomb ingredients, rented the Ryder truck to deliver the bomb, mixed the bomb with his co-conspirator Terry Nichols, and then drove it to Oklahoma City. McVeigh was even arrested fleeing the scene with bomb residue on him. No room for dispute, as far as I could tell, and the jury agreed, convicting McVeigh in short order. But in a broader sense, if not in a legal sense, there was a hole in the government's case. Why? When McVeigh was arrested and his face broadcast all over the country, it shocked a lot of Americans. This 27-year-old white guy with a crew cut killed 168 people? A decorated Army veteran did this?
Timothy McVeigh, age 27, the man with the light brown crew cut, was arrested by local authorities.
I remember I was driving back from post, it was like, 1730, 1800, and they said there was a suspect arrested and his name was Timothy McVeigh, and they had him in custody.
Ron Capus served in the Army with McVeigh. When the Oklahoma City bombing happened, Ron was still in the service, stationed at Fort Benning in Georgia. He was driving when he heard McVeigh's name.
And I had to pull over. I literally had to pull over because I was just in shock. I didn't know what to do. I wanted to call somebody, but I didn't know what to do at the time.
Soon, Ron and some other Army buddies got on the phone together.
I'm talking to a bunch of the guys and, how crazy this is and how fucked up it was. And I think, at the end of the day, it was just everybody was kind of just processing it for quite some time. I talk about Tim like he's a great guy, was a great soldier. And, but at the end of the day, what he did was despicable.
Everything that I'm saying to you right now, if you called my mom will say, oh, my son said this 20 years ago.
Hundreds of miles north of where Ron was, another former Army colleague of McVeigh's named Anthony Thigpen was living with his mom in Indiana.
I was standing on the stairwell halfway up, and there was a TV in her living room. And when it had his name on the screen, I'm like, whoa, my heart started racing. Because I'm like, I know him. I'm like, Mom, that's the dude I fought.
In the Army, Ron and Anthony saw very different sides of Tim McVeigh. And they had very different reactions about whether the man they knew was capable of committing the outrage that they saw on the news.
I thought he had more of a moral compass not to do something like that.
I was like, man, I knew something was wrong with him. I knew it. Man, that dude was a racist. I mean, it was like a aha moment.
To go down, to jump off the deep end like that and to do something that extreme, that I didn't think he had in him. I was pretty shocked.
I fought in war with you. I lived in the same barracks with you. And every black person in that unit knows that Timothy McVeigh was racist and didn't like the government that would see minorities as equal to himself.
When he entered the military, Timothy McVeigh was already primed to become a radical extremist. But it was in the Army that his short march down that path accelerated, especially because McVeigh's career as a soldier ended in a devastating failure. And just 3 years after that failure, McVeigh would have his twisted revenge at the Murrah Building. I'm Jeffrey Toobin, and this is Homegrown. Episode 2, Mr. Spotless. The military. What is the connection between the military and veterans and the movement you write about?
So this is an interesting point, and it's worth talking about quite carefully.
leading authority on the modern white power movement, Kathleen Belew.
What we would not want to imply is that veterans as a class or active duty troops as a class are somehow more extremist than other Americans. And I think history has borne out that that is not the case.
Here's what we know about veterans of the armed forces. The vast majority are upstanding, law-abiding citizens. It's not that members of the military are somehow more extremist. It's that among right-wing extremists, veterans are overrepresented compared to the general population.
Being affiliated with the military was the biggest predictor for being involved in an event like January 6th.
Here's what that means. Within the U.S. population, about 7% are either active duty military or veterans. But among those arrested on January 6th, that number is almost double, about 15%. And among leaders of the insurrection, veterans were even more highly represented. In the last episode, we talked about McVeigh's childhood. A comfortable middle-class existence outside Buffalo, but a precarious one. Parents with an unhappy marriage, and ultimately, when Tim was in high school, a nasty divorce. Tim was an average student, but he couldn't hack it at a local business college. While still living with his dad, McVeigh became a security guard, which allowed him to carry a gun. And that was his only real interest in life. Guns.
Guns were my hobby. They might have bordered on fascination, but more than that, everyone has to have a hobby.
These are McVeigh's own words, read by an actor.
Some men, it's baseball cards, and they know every stat of the baseball league, who hit how many home runs. Don't know shit about that. Should I call them fanatics about baseball? And what's wrong with that? Guns were just an area that I enjoyed studying and being up on.
McVeigh started working at Burke Security, an armored car service. By this point in his life, McVeigh had had almost no exposure to black people, beyond the vitriolic racism of his favorite book, The Turner Diaries. In his job as an armed guard, McVeigh was often tasked with delivering cash to check cashing places in Buffalo's inner city. McVeigh later recounted in an interview with his lawyer, Stephen Jones, how his colleagues would talk about black people.
The first thing I remember would be the derogatory terms everyone would use that I wasn't used to. You know, and porch monkey.
McVeigh later told his lawyers that he personally had no negative views of black people, but he did come to understand the prejudice of his white colleagues.
I started seeing as I worked there why they would come to these opinions. We would have a special delivery the last of every month to these check cashing places. We'd have to run them emergency shipments of money, and as we would drive up there, there would be a line of welfare recipients 3 blocks long waiting for money. We had to push our way in over their shoulders with our guns drawn, with nothing but black people looking for their welfare checks. And you would see as you drove by their houses during the rest of the month that all they would be doing is sitting on their porches. Hence, porch monkeys, waiting for their check.
Using the money he earned at Burke Security, McVeigh bought a new car. It was a Chevy Geo Spectrum with a turbocharged engine. McVeigh loved that car, and he gave it a nickname. The Road Warrior. McVeigh had a messianic streak. He felt that he was destined for great things, and that he was better than most everyone and everything around him.
A lot of people in my high school, I guess, were like this. I guess you would call them prissy. Nose in the air kind of thing. And when I saw myself on that same track, I said, I want to get down and dirty.
So when Tim was 20, he did what a good number of young people have done over the years when they're uncertain about their future.
Did he ever tell you he wanted to be in the Army?
No.
Bill McVeigh, Tim's dad, interviewed by ABC's Peter Jennings.
How did that come about?
What, being in the Army?
Yeah.
Heaven only knows. I come home one day and he says, Dad, I decided to go in the Army. And I says, Tim, when are you leaving? He says, tomorrow. That's the first I heard of it.
On May 24th, 1988, McVeigh drove the Road Warrior through the night to Georgia. The next morning, he arrived at Fort Benning for basic training.
Military service, I don't think, usually creates extremists where there were none before.
Kathleen Belew again.
But what it can do is give skills and training and expertise to these groups that can increase their violent capacity. And it can create networks through which extremists find other extremists.
In the military, McVeigh did form a small network that would become important for what came later. On his very first day at Fort Benning, McVeigh met another new recruit, a man who would play a big part in the Oklahoma City bombing, Terry Nichols. In Nichols, McVeigh found someone with like-minded politics whom he could impress and manipulate.
Yeah, Terry Nichols. Terry was a follower.
Sergeant Ron Capus also got to know Nichols in the Army.
So, you know, Charlie Brown, I always think, when I think of Terry Nichols, you know, the guy, Pigpen, who just walked around and was just kind of following around. I always looked at Terry as just the follower, and like I always just saw him as Pigpen. Not that he was dirty or anything, but like that's all he was. Like that's all he was good for, was just to kind of walk around.
Terry Nichols was from farm country in the Thumb of Michigan. He had a home, a wife, and a young son to support. He also had financial problems, so Nichols made the late decision to join the Army. When Nichols and McVeigh first met, Terry was 33 years old, far older than most new Army recruits. Tim was just 20. Their odd friendship would later curdle into a conspiracy, and it was born in the military. In those early days of basic training at Fort Benning, McVeigh made another good friend who would play a more limited role in the bombing, Michael Fortier.
Fortier, man, he was a 10-pound bag of shit stuffed in a 5-pound bag. His attitude, his professionalism, his motivation, everything was just like subpar from my perspective.
Michael Fortier was from Arizona, and he was about the same age as McVeigh. Fortier kind of drifted into the Army. He didn't share McVeigh's obsession with guns, and his main interest in life was getting high, mostly with pot, but also with whatever he could find, including acid and crystal meth. On the surface, McVeigh, Nichols, and Fortier appeared to have little in common, but they did bond over politics. Nichols had absorbed a militia-style ideology in Michigan, and he became kind of a tutor to the two younger men. Terry introduced him to the full text of the Declaration of Independence, the speeches of Patrick Henry, and even some 17th-century political philosophy from John Locke. The agenda was quasi-libertarian, but it was also aggressive and militaristic. At first, the Army was everything McVeigh hoped it would be. Soon after he arrived at basic training, he earned a commendation as a sharpshooter. McVeigh loved his new high and tight haircut. In a joyful letter to a childhood friend, he wrote,
"The Army and me are getting along well. I barely ever get yelled at, and everyone likes me, mainly because I do my job and that little extra. I always have my shit together."
When basic training was over, McVeigh, Nichols, and Fortier received their first real assignment. They had to report to an Army base near Junction City, Kansas, Fort Riley.
Yeah, so arriving at Fort Riley was a culture shock. And here I am, I get stuck in the middle of Kansas.
Ron Capus was also assigned to Fort Riley as a non-commissioned officer. Before that, he'd been stationed overseas in what was then West Germany. Capus said that the soldiers over there had a real sense of mission. They were well-trained, they were prepared. Fort Riley, Kansas, on the other hand,
felt like there was kind of like this cloud of laziness over everything. Folks were, you know, hanging out in the barracks, drinking beer, playing video games, you know, watching porn in group settings. It was kind of weird, actually, from my perspective. But there's also not a whole lot to do. You know, I could see a lot of drug use. You know, marijuana grows kind of out in the fields in Kansas. It's not like quality grade, but I always saw, you know, heavy drug use and alcohol use there for sure in the troops for sure.
Terry Nichols only lasted a few months at Fort Riley. His wife had divorced him, leaving their 7-year-old son to Terry's care. Nichols returned to Michigan in defeat. Meanwhile, McVeigh was making a name for himself compared to the soldiers around him.
As a soldier, if I lined up 100 of them, Tim would definitely be in the top 5 for sure, from my perspective of the ones that were there.
McVeigh was meticulous about his appearance, always wearing creased trousers, shine shoes, and polished brass. He earned the nickname Mr. Spotless.
He was much more respectful and, you know, seemed to at least be motivated to do things without kind of either giving you an attitude or kind of giving you lip or a roll of the eyes like a lot of them did.
He trained incessantly, even on his own time. McVeigh marched around the base carrying a heavy pack. He studied training manuals. He taught himself to disassemble and assemble weapons, blindfolded. Several of his former commanding officers would later tell the FBI the same thing. I wish I had a platoon full of Tim McVeighs. McVeigh was trained on Bradley fighting vehicles, which are kind of like tanks. They're designed both to attack targets and to transport troops. They can hold 12 soldiers, including a commander, a driver, and a gunner. Thanks to his shooting skills, McVeigh became a gunner. At the age of 22, McVeigh was the top-rated gunner out of 120 at Fort Riley. When he had time off, McVeigh read a lot. In the barracks, he studied the war fantasies in the Turner Diaries.
The plan, roughly, is this. Unit 8 will secure a large quantity of explosives, between 5 and 10 tons. Our unit will hijack a truck, making a legitimate delivery to the FBI headquarters. Rendezvous at a location.
McVeigh liked to tell his fellow soldiers about his favorite book.
I gave the Turner Diaries to a couple of guys to read because of the gun message. And even though I told them, I know you're not going to agree with the racial views, ignore them. That is not the worth of that book. There's a different worth to that book. That is, it's like a blueprint.
McVeigh also became a dedicated reader of Soldier of Fortune, a magazine focused on modern warfare. He would revel in the exploits of the Army's most elite units, Special Forces, also known as the Green Berets, and the Delta Force.
I was reasonable enough to realize that I could not meet the expectations they laid out for Delta Force, but I knew I could meet the expectations they laid out for Special Forces. I knew my test scores, my physical test scores, my road march times, etc., fell within those parameters.
This became McVeigh's new dream, to become a Green Beret. Suddenly, in the second half of 1990, it looked like McVeigh might see combat.
This will not stand. This will not stand, this aggression against Kuwait.
In August, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. President George H.W. Bush formed a multinational alliance to counter the Iraqis. As Hussein refused to withdraw, the chances for war grew. McVeigh and 100 or so soldiers from Fort Riley were shipped out to an airfield in Topeka. They were part of a massive wave of 700,000 American troops headed to the Gulf region. Each soldier was issued an M16 rifle, a 15-day supply of ammunition, and a 5-day supply of food. Because Saddam Hussein had a history of using chemical weapons, the soldiers also received a nerve gas survival suit, including an injection kit designed to counter the effects of poison gas. As he prepared to leave the United States, McVeigh wrote a letter home.
If there isn't a war, we stay 1 year. If there is, I'll probably be back a lot sooner. In a box.
So when I interviewed his Army buddies, they all spoke in glowing terms. And I think we interviewed a couple of officers. And he had a good reputation. People enjoyed being with him.
McVeigh's lead attorney, Stephen Jones, devoted a lot of effort to exploring the military career of his client.
Time and time again, when we would interview those he served with and his company, they would say the safest place to be was in McVeigh's tank. Any hostile fire, he could take care of. And so even if you were outside the tank, you had a certain degree of protection.
In the months before the war, a large majority of Americans favored military action to drive Iraq out of the small, oil-rich country of Kuwait. McVeigh's group arrived in the Gulf in early January 1991. They readied for action, and then nothing happened. Weeks passed as diplomatic efforts continued. McVeigh and the other soldiers had little to do except wait.
When I first met Timothy McVeigh, it was in Iraq.
Anthony Thigpen and McVeigh both served as squad leaders in the same unit.
I guess one of my first memories was the fact that he was quite standoffish. He did not interact with any of the black soldiers or the Mexican soldiers. He only would talk to the white soldiers, and that's what stood out the most. I mean, and the reason it stood out is because we were in a desert. So when we weren't in combat, there was a lot of card playing, jokes being cracked. We just all kind of connected, and we became a band of brothers. But he didn't interact with us.
Keeping to himself in the desert, McVeigh sent a lot of letters home. To his grandfather, he wrote,
"Now it's just a waiting game. Only fate knows if I'll be okay. The U.S. is going to kick some serious ass, no doubt, but there will be a cost."
On the same day, he wrote to his sister,
"We've been practicing for the attack day and night. I'm really not nervous. Kind of indifferent. If it's my time, it's my time. There's nothing you can do about that. I'm not nervous about doing my job. It's instinct now. I'm right on top of the Iraqi positions, 300 meters. If the artillery and air prep don't do their job, I'm pretty much SOL. Shit out of luck."
To a childhood friend, McVeigh was more macho.
"We're gonna bust through so fucking quick the Iraqis will think it's a bad dream. And when they blink to wake up, they'll be dead. I've made up my mind. No prisoners. It may be on my conscience for years, and I may be accused of killing defenseless people, but when push comes to shove and my life, along with the lives of everyone in my vehicle, is on the line, you've got to do what you got to do."
After the Bradley fighting vehicles arrived, the soldiers began final preparations for the invasion of Kuwait. McVeigh was assigned to be the gunner on a tank formerly designated as C-11, but McVeigh came up with a better name, and he scrawled it in block letters across the turret. Bad Company. It was a reference to one of his favorite songs, whose lyrics seemed to fit the moment. "Behind a gun, I'll make my final stand."
We saw enemy through the scopes, and he was thrilled about it. He was just excited.
Anthony Thigpen remembers that McVeigh couldn't wait to pull his trigger.
And to me, and not just to me, but to quite a few of us, that says something to us, like we're not over here excited to kill. You are, though. Like, we're doing what we got to do, but you're excited to do it.
50 minutes ago, American aircraft suddenly descended on Iraq and occupied Kuwait out of a very dark but very clear night sky. The war in the Persian Gulf has begun. What was known for so long as Operation Desert Shield is now called by President Bush Desert Storm.
Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait. These attacks continue as I speak.
Let's describe to our viewers what we're seeing. The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. We're seeing bright flashes going off all over the sky.
At 5:02 a.m. on February 24, 1991, McVeigh and his comrades launched their assault. At first, they encountered no Iraqi troops at all. Then 3 hours later, they fired their first shots at what appeared to be an infantry unit.
I'll be honest with you, the adrenaline was pumping like for days.
The Americans had trained for pitch battles, but it would turn out that the Iraqis had neither the resources nor the will to put up much of a fight. Ron Capus remembers Iraqi troops surrendering in droves.
We came across, I must have been a group of 15 to 20 Iraqis that came out, waving a white flag and walked right straight up to our vehicle.
On the second day of the ground war, McVeigh's commander spied what looked like a machine gun nest dug into the desert about a mile away. Inside the Bradley vehicle, McVeigh stared into his viewfinder, which had 12 times magnification. He squeezed the trigger on the 25-millimeter cannon to launch a high-explosive shell. In an interview after his arrest with Lou Michel and Dan Herbick, two Buffalo journalists, McVeigh recalled what happened next. At the last minute, an Iraqi soldier stood up.
"His head just disappeared. I saw everything above his shoulder disappear, like in a red mist."
McVeigh had killed two soldiers. Anthony Thigpen again.
When he hit the target, he was thrilled. It was just a sense of excitement that went beyond humanity.
The first Gulf War was a rout. The Iraqi army had nowhere near the power or the technology of the U.S.-led coalition. The Allied forces, under the command of General H. Norman Schwarzkopf, declared a unilateral ceasefire just 100 hours after the ground attack began. Army Sergeant Ron Capus.
I think when you look back at, you know, the speed and how quickly that we executed that shock and awe plan, the forces in Iraq that were caught in Kuwait that started to try to pull out got leveled by the Air Force. Like, if you had seen the dead bodies on the road that we spent time burying, it was crazy.
Timothy McVeigh saw some horrible things in combat, but if he did have any kind of post-traumatic stress disorder, it was never diagnosed. Attorney Stephen Jones again.
We searched his military records. We could not find anything that indicated there was any emotional problem, mental problem, PTSD. None of that was indicated. He was just a normal GI grunt that served and came back.
Commendations and promotions came quickly in wartime. McVeigh received the Army Commendation Medal. According to the citation, he had inspired his fellow soldiers by, quote, destroying an enemy machine gun emplacement, killing two Iraqi soldiers, and forcing the surrender of 30 others from dug-in positions. McVeigh was also awarded four other medals, including a Bronze Star for his service in Desert Storm. On March 3, 1991, McVeigh was on an airstrip near the Iraqi border town of Safwan. General Schwarzkopf was presiding over a peace conference of sorts.
Let me just say that we have just completed what I think were very frank, very candid, and very constructive discussion with the Iraqi military.
In truth, the general was dictating the terms of surrender to his Iraqi counterparts. As a reward for its excellent performance during the brief war, McVeigh's company was invited to provide security. Their Bradley vehicles were lined up in a massive show of force for the Iraqis and for the television cameras. McVeigh wrote a breathless letter to his mother.
If you didn't see me on the news yesterday, you never will. We were guarding the peace talks, and our Bradley was parked 50 yards from the main tent. Everyone got us on film. CNN, ABC, NBC, CBS, UPI, etc. I talked with Tom Brokaw, cool guy, and had my picture taken shaking General Schwarzkopf's hand.
The war was over. The soldiers in the Gulf were suddenly in limbo, wondering what was next for them.
I think the focus for everybody was, you know, when are we going home? And because there was no real information on anything. And I think Tim at that time got notified of, you know, his acceptance to the Q course.
The Q course, short for Special Forces Qualification Course.
It's about a 3-week course where they go in and they, you know, give you a bunch of tasks that you need to complete, and they put you under a little bit of mental duress too. And I, you know, try to see, you know, how those folks that can kind of handle it or not handle it.
On March 26, while still in the desert, McVeigh was informed that he now had a chance to try out for his dream job. But Capus thought McVeigh had a lot going against him.
Getting orders to go to the Q course from Iraq is really tough because, you know, you need to be prepared when you go. And he tried to exercise, you know, in Iraq. But there's nothing saying that you couldn't get prepared out there, you know, other than the fact that by the time the sun came up at 8 a.m, you know, you were getting your chestnuts roasted on an open fire already. It was so goddamn hot out there. It was crazy.
At that point, everyone was trying to get back from the Gulf. I had to find any way I could.
McVeigh had just 30 minutes to gather his gear and figure out a way to get out of Kuwait in order to report to Fort Bragg in North Carolina by April 1st.
I jumped on the back of a Chinook helicopter that was already overcrowded, got to the Kuwaiti airfield. This is where my charismatic skills came in. There was a female Air Force sergeant there that was not going to let me on, and I just kind of sweet-talked her into letting me on this flight to get back to the States.
This moment, as McVeigh rose into the air and left the Persian Gulf, ranked as the precise high point in his life. He had found a welcoming home in the Army. He had tested himself in war and emerged as a decorated hero. McVeigh's dream of becoming a Green Beret was tantalizingly within reach. Back in the States, McVeigh was one of the first Desert Storm soldiers to return home. He was saluted and admired wherever he went. When airline pilots introduced him, passengers applauded. And McVeigh had a one-night stand with a woman he met in a bar. Still, McVeigh had his work cut out for him. He was one of only five soldiers just back from the desert for the Special Forces tryouts. Given the swift turnaround, the brass at Fort Bragg asked if they were ready for the 21 days of tests.
At that point, we were so excited to be back and weren't thinking. We said yes. We kind of knew in our hearts we weren't, but we were going to try.
McVeigh lasted 2 days. Soon after McVeigh left the Q Course, he returned to Fort Riley. Ron Capus ran into him at a barbecue where he and other soldiers peppered McVeigh with questions.
Because obviously everybody was interested in him. It's not like every day, you know, that somebody gets accepted to go to the Q Course. You know, it really isn't. It's kind of a big deal to get accepted to it. So I remember we spent most of that barbecue talking about that, and that's when I really noticed kind of the big change in him.
McVeigh told his audience about being forced to go on a long march of unknown duration. He said he was issued a new pair of combat boots, but he didn't have the chance to break them in.
I knew something was wrong. My knees were aching, blisters started breaking out on my feet, and that was just the first road march.
McVeigh made it for the first 5 miles, thinking the march was over, and then he was ordered to march farther.
And he said everything was a mind fuck, and that was his, he had this huge problem with it. And I was just like, okay, but I thought it was always supposed to be a mind fuck.
McVeigh quit the march and told an officer that he was dropping out. As was his pattern, McVeigh rationalized his failure by insisting he never really wanted to be in Special Forces all that much anyway. And he started trashing the Green Berets.
I'd never heard him be so disparaging, you know, in front of me. And I remember us having a pretty lengthy conversation about it for a while until you could see he was kind of getting agitated by kind of all the Q&A. So then we just kind of stopped and started, you know, barbecuing and drinking beer like we normally do.
Was that disappointing for you to not make it?
It was. But at the same time, I was losing motivation. This was during a period when I was coming to grips with my role in the Gulf War.
McVeigh granted only one broadcast interview. It was with 60 Minutes. He's in a maximum security prison about 5 years after the Oklahoma City bombing.
I went over there hyped up, just like everyone else. Not only is Saddam evil, all Iraqis are evil. What I experienced, though, was an entirely different ballgame. And being face-to-face, close with these people, in personal contact, you realize they're just people like you.
McVeigh was following a familiar pattern among generations of warriors. They come home from battle and suffer a catastrophic letdown. McVeigh came to believe that the United States should simply stay out of other countries' business, and that the government should just leave people alone.
We got a house together for a short time, and, you know, McVeigh's a weird son of a bitch, and everything about him is weird.
In the fall of 1991, Army Private John Kelso moved into a house near Fort Riley with some other buddies from his platoon. Timothy McVeigh moved in, too, and he was not a good roommate.
And then he painted all the windows black in his room, and because he had all these damn guns and stuff.
Kelso remembers McVeigh was playing around with his guns constantly, thus his paranoia about the windows.
He ate pizza. He hardly ever ate in the chow hall. He ordered pizza every night, and he watched a lot of gory movies. He enjoyed the horror, the death and destruction type of stuff.
Kelso says McVeigh would watch a VHS tape called Faces of Death, a graphic cult film that depicted scenes of people being brutally killed.
Sitting around watching these goddamn horror flicks, this Faces of Death, laughing about it. Oh, you guys ought to come down and look. This guy gets run over and cut in five pieces on this train track. And I don't remember if that's what it was, but you know, it was just gory shit like that. And he'd been there laughing, eating pizza, you know, having a good time with us. Like, man, you've just lost all touch with reality.
At Timothy McVeigh's trial, the defense brought on soldiers who knew McVeigh from the Army. They testified that McVeigh was an exemplary serviceman. but John Kelso says those witnesses left the Army soon after the Gulf War, and they didn't see McVeigh in the later months the way he did.
These guys are constantly, you know, making him out to be this big fucking savior in the military. You know, you guys all went home three days after we got home from Desert Storm. You didn't see how all this shit kind of unraveled. There was a time when he was, you know, the great blue hope, and you know, he had all these aspirations of being a career military guy. But when he didn't get his way, you know, he needed somebody else to blame. He wanted somebody else to blame but himself. He's the motherfucker that failed the Q course.
That was the great turning point in McVeigh's life, his failure in the tryout for the Green Berets. If he had made the grade, it's likely he would have spent the next few years, and perhaps the rest of his working life, as a soldier, one with extreme right-wing views, but mainly a competent, focused member of the military. Without the Green Berets, though, he was left to marinate in his resentments.
He just turned into a dirtbag. He didn't press his uniforms anymore. I think a lot of it was depression. Most of it was anger, and he just changed. And that flame wasn't going to blow out either, and it didn't.
Also at Fort Riley, McVeigh's racism hardened. The base already had a poisonous racial environment. Sergeant Anthony Thigpen.
Fort Riley was known to be one of those bases that if you were a minority, you didn't want to be stationed there, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, because it was racist.
Among McVeigh's complaints about black soldiers were, quote,
"The loud, rough music, the lowriders together with bass music, the loudness in the barracks and everywhere else, the staying up and keeping others up all night, the playing of dominoes loud all night. It seemed like a form of psychological warfare in which black soldiers were purposely bothering other people."
McVeigh gave excuses for his own failures by saying that minorities were getting special treatment. When two black soldiers were chosen instead of him to attend sniper school, McVeigh was outraged because he thought he was better qualified.
There was a lot of things that was very clear to us that it was unquestionable that you didn't like us.
As a decorated sergeant, McVeigh would give orders to a squad of privates. Thigpen was also a sergeant, and he says that under McVeigh, only non-white soldiers would be assigned labor-intensive, menial jobs.
So I went to McVeigh, and I'm like, "Man, why are you sending all the black guys and the Mexican guys to do this and to do that?" And he was like, "Man, you nick the N-word, always want something, always think you gotta come first." And I said, "Us what?" And he repeated it, and I hit him, and it went from there, and it got broken up, and of course, you know, we had to go see the captain.
Soon after this fight, McVeigh was on his way out the door. After 3.5 years in the service, he resigned with an honorable discharge effective in December 1991. McVeigh had served only 6 months after returning from the Gulf. When he enlisted, McVeigh was already a gun-obsessed racist. However, simply being among the legions of returning veterans from a foreign war put McVeigh into a historical pattern for susceptibility to right-wing extremism.
So, for instance, if we look at numbers in the Ku Klux Klan from its founding in the 1860s to the present, the best predictor of increases is the aftermath of a major military mobilization.
History professor Kathleen Ballou again.
So that's a more consistent predictor than poverty or populism or large waves of immigration or gains in civil rights for minority groups. There is something about the aftermath of war that spurs big waves of this kind of activity. So we can trace this after the Civil War, after World War I, after World War II, after Vietnam, and now after the global war on terror.
His dream of special forces dashed, McVeigh had no plan B. With nothing else to do and nowhere else to go, he returned to his father's house near Buffalo.
Well, cripes, when he came home from the service, and he walked right in the bedroom I was sleeping. "Hi, Dad, I'm home." He surprised the hell out of me. I thought he was still over in the war.
Did he ever tell you what it meant to him not to make it into special forces?
No. We never talked about that, and I ain't even sure I ever asked.
The arrangement with his dad was difficult, but at least it was rent-free. Tim needed work, and he thought he could parlay his military experience into a job with the U.S. Marshals Service. In a story he would tell over and over, McVeigh said he did very well on the written test, but he was turned down for the job because he was a, quote, white male, and the marshals only wanted women and African Americans. In those melancholy days after he left the Army, McVeigh's disillusionment festered and grew. His Army medals didn't mean anything anymore, and he was deeply unsatisfied with his lot in life. Here's McVeigh again, interviewed by Ed Bradley of 60 Minutes.
It's hard for some people to come to grips with you as the same person who was commended by the Army, who received the Bronze Star, as being the same person who was convicted in the Oklahoma City bombing. They can't put the two together. You understand that?
I do understand. And many people have thrown this at me. They say, well, Tim, imagine the paradox. In the Gulf War, you were given medals for killing people. So I've faced that that issue quite a few times with people that bring it up to me.
Sounds like you were pretty angry when you came back.
I believe I had anger welling in me, yes.
Tim McVeigh was a smart guy. And he would have undoubtedly, if he'd applied himself, and he certainly could apply himself, done well in college. Community college, four-year school, even a state university.
McVeigh's lawyer, Stephen Jones.
He had discipline. He learned from being in the Army. And he could have succeeded, but he took these other jobs and so was really exposed to the ordinary working class.
Back home, McVeigh returned to what he had done before. With a pistol permit and a security clearance from the Army, he became a supervisor at an armored car company. He hated the security job.
The stress to that job, though, and of working in the city started eating at me slowly, as well as the political stress. Stress of the job would be traffic, working with idiots, the boss was an asshole, low pay. Stresses of home would be sleeping on the couch every night. Stress from the politics, well, examples are tough at this point because they take up 10 pages, but they come from my heightened sense of awareness of what the news was really saying.
At this point, all McVeigh really had was his gun collection and the road warrior.
Then basically Tim hit the road. And by hit the road, I mean he had this old car and he started going to gun shows. Then, of course, the politics that were at gun shows was definitely of one sort.
With his dream in the military dashed and life in his hometown a dull dead end, McVeigh decided to search for an adventure somewhere else. While stewing about his failures in life, he listened to the news, and McVeigh became convinced that the government that sent him to war was now going after people like him.
I immediately said, "Stop the car, my story's on that hill."
Next time on Homegrown, Tim hits the road.
And it was a man who was all by himself, very unassuming, sitting on the hood of his car. And he said that the Koresh standoff is only the beginning and that people should watch the government's role and heed any warning signs.
Homegrown Oklahoma City is a USG audio podcast produced by Western Sound in association with Esmail Corp. It's reported, written, and hosted by me, Jeffrey Toobin. Executive producers are Josh Block at USG Audio, Sam Esmail and Chad Hamilton at Esmail Corp., and Western Sound's Ben Adair and Colin McNulty, who is also the editor. Production support from Josh Laulongi at USG Audio. The producer and sound designer is Tyler Hill. The associate producer is Stella Hartman. The producer from Esmail Corp. is Sarah Maddy. Original theme and engineering by Alex McGinnis. Fact-checking by Nicole McNulty and Savannah Wright. Special thanks to Betsy Shepard and Dan Leone. Passages of Timothy McVeigh are read by Chris Cowan. Our gratitude also to the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum and the Briscoe Center at the University of Texas. For more information on this podcast and other podcasts by USG Audio, go to our website, usgaudio.com. And to learn even more, read my book, Homegrown, Timothy McVeigh and the rise of right-wing extremism.